Welcome to season two of Beyond Beauty. I'm so excited. Where I talk with visionary artists who share their journeys, influences, and creative processes. My name is Jacqueline Cofield, and I research and study artistic praxis. This season brings together a wonderful and diverse lineup of voices, artists whose roots and cultural backgrounds shape the art they bring to the world. Each conversation reveals not just the artwork, but the personal and collective narratives that inspire it. Join me as we explore the intricate blend of heritage, creativity, and purpose that defines these remarkable women artists. Today is a conversation that I have eagerly anticipated since the podcast's launch. Joining us is an artist whose work resonates with vibrancy and vitality, the incomparable Bisa Butler. Bisa's quilts tell stories that are woven from the threads of African-American and African diasporic histories, celebrating heroes and everyday folk alike. Her unique approach to portraiture and the use of color and fabric capture the spirit and complexity of Black lives. So, I'm thrilled to share this enriching dialogue with you all. Let's get started and welcome Bisa Butler to Beyond Beauty. Oh my gosh. Honestly, I couldn't sleep last night, and it's partly because I ended up with swimmer's ear from traveling home, but also because I was just so excited about this interview. Ever since I started the podcast, I've been thinking about interviewing you, and I just can't believe this moment is here. I just want to start with such gratitude. Thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule. I know you have so much going on, and I'm just really humbled and honored and overjoyed by your presence today. So, Bisa Butler, you don't even need an introduction. I'm just honored to have you here today on Beyond Beauty Podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jacqueline. I've been looking forward to it. I know we've been talking about this for a while, so I'm glad that the schedules and the stars have finally aligned.
Yes. And I think you must be in your studio. I'm looking at behind you. So
yes.
You might be taking a break or getting ready.
Don't remind me. There's so much work left to be done.
Oh, well, I think that's sort of always the case, right?
So, yes.
But as an educator, I'm here in Teachers College, Columbia University. You know, this is where I record these sessions. This is where this podcast was sort of birthed through my dissertation work on studying the practices of Black women artists. You know, I've been so thrilled in particular because of your background as an educator. So we're going to get there. But I want to say first that I've been able to share space with you. You didn't know this because you were always the guest of honor, but I was honored to share space with you twice in the last year, once at the Jeffrey Deitch Gallery and then again at Soho House when you did this talk on the art of storytelling. And so I've heard you speak and been in your presence. I've seen your work in person. And so I was... During those times where I was in the room with you, I was like, oh gosh, I just wish I could like speak to her. So like, this is like a dream, a dream.
Thank you. And that means a lot to me. That exhibit with Jeffrey was just like the culmination of so many hopes and dreams, like probably starting from like high school on.
Yes.
So anybody who like got to see it or even just walk by, it just added to it, adds to how important it is to me.
Yeah. And how important you are to us, because you're sort of walking in the path of freedom dreaming and we're observing it and able to, you know, to be in the room and hear you speak. And even for the people who are not in the room with you, even just people who, you know, get a chance to go to museums to see your work or in galleries or even to read about your work. Whether it's, you know, even if they're looking online, you give us an example, you give us a model that is really so inspirational. So my first question, I want to ask you about your values around education. Your parents are both educators. Your father was a college president and your mother a French teacher. Donc, vous parlez français un peu?
Oui, je parle un peu français.
D'accord,
d'accord.
Okay. Oui, c'est bon. So how have these experiences with your parents, who two educators, how have they, and you know, these values that you learned from them influenced your artistic practice, your journey?
I can remember being around my parents as they either prepared for lessons or prepared for something my whole life. My father started at the college where he eventually became the president in 1968. So that was before I was born. So I don't really have a memory of like not being sort of in a collegiate atmosphere and running through those big halls and knowing some people simply by like Dean so-and-so. And I knew from the start how much education had shaped and formed their lives. My father immigrated from Ghana in about, I think it was around 1963 on an academic scholarship. So I always knew that he wouldn't be in this place, nor would he have met my mother. My father went to Seton Hall, and his philosophy professor was my grandfather, my mother's father. And he was a Black man from Nova Scotia. And he had an affinity for foreign national students because he was one. Even though Canadians, people don't always think of them as being immigrants, he spoke French and he was treated like an outsider. And he also knew that feeling of being in a foreign land and having no home to go to on Thanksgiving, Christmas, or so-and-so. And he invited my father to one of these. I don't even know if it was a Thanksgiving. It was probably just Sunday dinner. And that's how my father and mother met. So my existence and being alive on this planet comes directly through education and scholarship and human connection. And so I always knew how important it was to not only for me to do well, but then also what kind of options there were in a life as an educator. Growing up at walking through the halls of Essex County College, I met all kinds of people, from computer to the bursar to the librarian, you know, just the whole gambit, the art teachers. And then my mother taught French, which we talked about a little bit, and she taught high school French. And not only was she a teacher and her father a professor, but she had nine brothers and sisters. And I'd say about half of them went into education as well. Well, I grew up with the idea that not only do you come, you directly are alive because somebody went to school, but that this is a promising and rewarding career.
I love the idea of you walking through the halls from such a young age. When you were saying that, it made me think of my daughter, who, when I started my doctoral journey, she was 1 year old. So she literally grew up on the Columbia campus. And I have so many photos of like bringing her through the hallways, first in a stroller to now she loves to run. Wow. Teachers College takes up a whole block. So it's so big and kids love it. And we do things like Kids Day.
I remember that too, running through the halls, being really small.
It's so much fun. They just love, you know, sometimes I bring her on the weekend just so she can run around through the halls. And I just hope that she has these memories. So as a mom, I'm really grateful to hear that story.
Yes.
So then you grew up in South Orange, New Jersey, attended schools there. And then you went to Howard University in HBCU, which my sister, my younger sister also went there. So we have, she's a Alpha Chapter Delta Proud Bison in the family. So how did your experience at Howard, at an HBCU, relate to or differ from your earlier learning environments? And how did it shape your artistic journey?
Howard was completely different than anything I had experienced. Growing up, my very first school environments were non-traditional. My mother was an American woman, but raised in Morocco. And she didn't come back to this country till like late 60s, like right around the time when she met my father. But her formative years were spent in international school, with French kids, Moroccan kids, Algerian kids, Ghanaian kids. It's those international schools, you know, you have kids from all over the world. So that, I would say the hippie lifestyle was already in her before she got back to the States. And to put us in the structured traditional schools that she went to, like Catholic schools, she didn't want. And my first school was the Rainbow School, which is, it was, I guess you could call it Montessori, but it was a step further than that.
Mm.
It was a big Victorian house with no grades. And the ages were like 5 to 12 and no set classroom.
So everybody was mixed together, the different age groups were mixed together?
Mixed together, and there'd be like an English room, an art room, a math room, history room, music room. The kids were allowed to decide where they wanted to be during the day. And I spent all my days in the art room. And my sister, for some reason, I mean, not for some reason, I shouldn't throw shade, but she spent all her days in the math room. And I'm like, why are you in there? It's so much better over here. And so my very first experiences in school were in like a studio environment, which it would be, in my memory, it would just be me and the teacher. Because at Rainbow School, you could play outside. It didn't matter if it was raining or snowing. If it was raining, you could roll up your pants if it was warm and just be barefoot in the mud. It was very much like a laissez-faire school environment. And then when we left Rainbow School, we went to an Afrocentric school in North New Jersey called the Chad School. And the Chad School was very regimented next to Rainbow. We had little uniforms that were green and yellow that had a globe that had Africa on it. We used to say that the seven principles of Kwanzaa in the morning instead of the Pledge of Allegiance. And then we would sing the Black National Anthem.
Oh, wow.
So my first experience in like organized school environment was indoctrination in an African-American centered environment. We called all our teachers brother and sister. My mom taught there too. She taught first grade. So my mother's name is Natalie, so she was Sister Nazi. And
wow.
Yeah, it was totally different. But it was different to me than Rainbow School because of the structure. But it wasn't different to me because of what happens in typical American schools, because I didn't have that experience in the first place.
Right.
By the time, let me see. I think so my father went to Catholic school in Africa. And if you know how African boarding schools are, it's very strict. It's not anything like any of the environments that I was in.
Mm.
An Afrocentric curriculum is nothing like when he was in Ghana. Ghana was still a British colony, and they used to sing God Save the Queen in the morning.
Oh.
So my parents divorced, and when he visited the Chad school, I think that was probably our last day there. It ended very quickly because he was like, this is not at all what I want my kids to be learning. And my mother was willing to let my father step in and I guess negotiate and decide like what our education would be like. Like she had the early portion. And then by third grade, we had moved to South Orange, went to public school.
Mm.
That was the first time I had been in a typical American school. I had to learn the Pledge of Allegiance.
What grade was that? What grade was that? Third grade. Okay.
I was 8.
Yeah.
I had not been in a public school in the way of like the bullying that happens in more public schools. And it could be bullying from your teachers or other kids. This is the 80s. So I don't think anti-bullying was a thing. It was like, if somebody was doing something that the other kids deemed like weird or whatever, I think the teachers would just fall silent and be like, yeah, go ahead and stop. And I stayed in South Orange and Maplewood public schools all the way up until I went to Howard. And in that environment, I think the Black population is probably about 10-15%.
Okay.
And South Orange is very close to New York. And a lot of the parents were upwardly mobile. I ended up teaching at the school where I graduated from, Columbia High School. Mm-hmm. And the Bastiat twins, they're the nieces of Jean-Michel Bastiat, were some of my students. And when I was in school, like Lauryn Hill was a year under me. So we had these, since I graduated from Columbia High School in like 2009, I think, or eight. But you have upwardly mobile Black families who the mother or the father live or work in New York and have creative careers. So that adjacency meant that a lot of the kids had the opportunity to do voiceovers for cartoons because their parents worked in that industry.
Mm.
There were a lot of kids who would leave school half day and go to Broadway, not always because their parents worked in it, but it was access.
Mm.
You had the financial ability. You had even 10% in those days was like considered good mixed race environment. I had a lot of friends who were biracial and they chose, the parents weren't selected. The parents selected South Orange and Maplewood, the adjoining town, because they were known to be racially tolerant.
Mm.
Large Jewish population, larger queer population, and interracial, which large at that time, who knows? You know, it's like 85, 86. It could be 5 to 10%, but nobody is going to harass you or beat you up or set your house on fire, you know, or harm you. And by the time I got to power, that was mind-blowing again, because I got to Howard in 1991, and there was a new Black Power movement budding at that time. Public Enemy was really popular. That album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. We listened to, me and my friends listened to a lot of Jungle Brothers, Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul. So the music influenced us a lot. We were starting to see the Dreads. Although Dreads had never like gone out of popularity, they were getting more mainstream.
Because
before that, if you wore locks, it was like you were either a Rasta or somebody who had an alternative lifestyle. But when we got to Howard, people were just wearing locks because they thought that they were beautiful.
Yeah.
We started wearing African style clothing. And that was my first exposure to, I would say, the philosophy of Black power. Because way back at Chad School, they were teaching us little kids like this. This was your history. I didn't know it was an anti-history or an alternative history.
Mm.
That just was the building blocks. But at Howard, we started reading things like W.E.B. Du Bois and Stokely Carmichael and Maya Angelou or Angela Davis, or they would come up on campus. And that was something that I had never heard before. My father and mother grew up in places where the majority of the people were African, whether they were North African in Morocco or West African in Ghana. They didn't grow up feeling that they had to assert their Blackness and their right to be proud of themselves, their hair, their complexion, their style of dress, the way they speak.
Mm.
But all those years in South Orange and Maplewood Public School, I very much understood that I was at a step as a person of African descent. And not just because I was Black, because a lot of my friends, they were Black American through and through. And I think they felt comfortable in that space. But I was often told by Black American kids and white that, you know, you're different because you're African.
Mm.
So that was a whole nother a barrier of entry. Even though I was born and raised here, because I look African, and I am African. You know, my maiden name's Yamba. But right away with the roll call, Yamba was like, oh, what? Did you have shoes growing up? That kind of thing was pretty typical.
Oh, goodness.
So Howard was great because I felt an awakening. Like all of the things that I had been taunted with throughout the typical primarily white public school made sense now. Now I knew why my Black American classmates felt ashamed or felt that they didn't want to accept me because of that, the white supremacist ideals that we were all getting through osmosis, or just watching TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood that there were alternatives to that alternative thought. And it helped me to put my own childhood together, understand my father's experiences through colonialism in Ghana. And he was there when Ghana was liberated. And so I was finally asking him questions like that. What was it like the night before? What is it like when your whole country is suddenly a free and independent nation? And to see Kwame Nkrumah live speaking. And Howard was great because my classmates were the children of other kids like me who grew up in the suburbs, who weren't around a lot of Black people like themselves. There were West Indian immigrants, African immigrants. There were kids from California, from Mississippi, and those of us from the Northeast. It was a true cultural melting pot. And some of my classmates were the children of people I had read about in books. Like our really good friend was one of the sons of Amiri Baraka.
Mm.
And Raz Baraka, who's now the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, was the president of Black Nia Force, which was a student revolutionary group on campus that I was a part of. So when people ask me, like, did you pledge? I'm like, no, I was part of Black Nia Force. Although my daughter went to Howard and pledged, AKA, so.
I have to say,
both worlds.
Because my sister went to Howard, I know so many people went to Howard, and Howard alums do not play. I mean, there's something special happening at Howard, and yes. It was always a big regret for me or lament that I didn't have the opportunity to study at an HBCU, because many people in my family, my father, my sisters, they all have. And that's, something I always wanted to have that experience. And so maybe one day, maybe I'll have that experience, maybe one day teaching.
I remember my grandmother who graduated from Xavier during the days. She graduated probably in 1936 or 1937. But when she found out I wanted to go to Howard, she was outraged in a bad way. She was like, why do you want to go down there? She's like, I thought you would have wanted to go to one of the best schools.
Ooh. And meanwhile, the people that I know went to Howard are all killing it in their respective careers. They're like all at the top of their game. I mean, that's a misconception that people have, but meanwhile, people are killing it who are coming out of HBCUs. And so I love that you highlight or amplify that experience. It's so important.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm sitting here at Teachers College where Alma Adams, many Black artists have studied, come through. I've even been able to take an intro to painting class. I took the class only because I felt like I should, I'm studying artists, working with artists. I feel like I should try to see what they're going through.
Yeah.
Ooh, that class was, it was not easy. And I'm still working on, I'm still, but I'm so grateful for that experience. I think, one of my friends told me, I think art historians, all curators, all people working with artists should take practice studio classes. And so, every studio class I've been able to take has just magnified my respect. So many Black women artists have participate in this tradition of being an educator, like Alma Adams, who spent many years, Faith Ringo, many years. There's a long list, and you are in that group. So I definitely, as I was preparing for this, I was like, I don't want to ask her all the same questions that she gets asked. So I don't know if people are asking you about this, but I really want to hear more you talk about your experience as a teacher. Was it a public school, in high school? Mm-hmm. What did you learn about yourself? What is something memorable that you've taken away from that experience that empowers you today? Many people who may listen to my podcast will be either educators or they're people who are thinking about education or thinking about schooling. So I'm just curious, what's your perspective on all these things?
My experience as a teacher was at first shocking. I was a public school teacher. I taught for 2 years in middle school, and then I went to high school. And I was not prepared for the amount of social emotional learning that the kids would need and the structure that I would need to understand classroom management and the psychology behind it. Like, how, you know, it's not just shouting, or it's not just like you're not trying to be punitive. How do you get 30 youth to agree with what you want to do? How does that work? And so that was a shock. It's not the same thing, like you said, as I knew how to make art. And I thought, okay, I had all these ideas, all these lessons that I wanted to do right off the bat. And like any teacher would tell you that usually turns out very badly because the classroom could be total chaos. And not only just the management of it, but how to teach something in bites so that everybody can get it. You can't just push on through right to the end without realizing where is the actual beginning of this project. When I wanted to teach my students how to quilt, I realized the actual beginning is like keeping your materials organized. Like your needle, your scissors, your fabric, that kind of thing. And then the very simple steps, like how to thread a needle, how to make a knot at the end of the string. And these are high school kids. But if you've never done that, you zip through thinking, okay, thread your needles, tie a knot. We're going to like, no.
Right. It'd be scaffolding.
Yes, the scaffolding. And then how much that helps everybody, because you have different levels of learning in the room. And children can be very gifted in one subject and not so much, and how much that would switch. I felt like mainly the teaching really taught me how to be a better human being, how to care about people, large amounts of people. And then not only that, but how to win people over. Because if a child does not believe in you and what you're showing them, they don't care what you were saying at all, and they do not have to do it. I've seen what happens in a classroom or in a school when this doesn't happen. As those are things you might see online, like teachers and students having tussles over phones, not like actual fights, but snatching of a phone or snatch it back, or the throwing of desks, the eruptions of frustration and anger. A lot of those things, part of the genesis is just a lack of respect and understanding. And I had kids from very different backgrounds. Some of them came from parents who were not as financially set up as they wanted to be. Some of my students, you know, always lived with their parents. They may live with a relative, or sometimes they were in the foster care system. And I had some students who were homeless as well. But at the end of the day, it always seemed like each kid needs to know that you care about them. I want to pronounce your name correctly. That's huge.
Yeah.
If you mispronounce somebody's name, like if I jumped on here and I was like, hey, Jocelyn, like it's just, you know, this was, did you not read the name? And if you couldn't pronounce it, could you ask me? Like that is an affront right there. And then if you refuse to say it correctly because you can't or won't make that important, you're already saying, like, your name is not important to me. That's the name that your mother gave you. And she is not important to me either. The way she pronounces and spells your name is, if it's, you know, we as African Americans and Dominicans, I have learned, we like to be creative with names. Create your child's name. And I had a student who told me once, I think her name was, I don't know, I think it was Shaniqua. And she was like, oh, don't worry, my name is Ghetto. And I said, your name is not Ghetto. Your mother named you a name that she thought was, is beautiful. And every name was made up at some point. Somebody thousands of years ago was like, I think Mary is nice. And everybody else had never heard that name before. So why is your mother's original creation less than somebody else's name that came from many years over. So I just wanted the kids to know that I cared about them from mm-hmm. the start mm-hmm. and then share aspects of myself. I care about teaching and I care about art. And these are the things that I'd like to do, but I need to make sure that you're okay sitting here. If you are hungry, I don't think you can focus. None of us can focus when we're hungry.
Right.
Right. In a meeting, you're just like, I'm hungry.
Right. Totally. As adults, I mean, that's so real. They say hangry.
Hangry. These are fundamentals. So I felt like teaching also taught me to love. Because there were kids, it was my first experience meeting non-binary children or children who were trying to figure out how to express who they really are. And I had to understand that all of my class needed love. Like the high school football star who everybody loved mm-hmm. still needed to know that his teacher cared about him, as did the kid who's ostracized and nobody's speaking to. Like, you can't take anything for granted that just because one student is rich and good looking mm-hmm. and that the other one is wearing the same clothes and sits alone, that they don't equally need love and attention. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that changed me as a human being. And it made me think about when I used to walk in the classroom in the morning, I used to say to myself, first of all, do no harm. Because kids can test you, high school kids. They're going to, because they want to know, how do you actually care about them? And if the situation is at home, that love is shown in a different way, maybe they want to know, how are you going to show it? If I make you really, really mad, are you going to reject me? But even if they did make me mad, I had to find a way inside myself that I'm not going to harm this child. I'm going to let them know that what they did was not right or I didn't like it. And let's try to fix it because we have to meet again here tomorrow, same time, same place. But those were all testing grounds. The ones who tested me the most, I remember this one kid. Why he did this, I do not know. But somehow he had jumped up on the table and was making some kind of declamation. He was showing out a lot. This is a sophomore kid, like not a little baby. And I did fuss at him. Not in a cruel way, but I did, like, I lost my temper in that way. And then after that, that kid loved me forever. He just wanted to be near me, and he wanted to pass out all the paper, to sharpen all the pencils, and clean up everything because he felt he had pushed me to my limit, but my limit was not cruelty or ostracization, or it could be punitive in a way, but more like, I want you to do the right thing, but mm-hmm. I'm not trying to hurt you. Mm-hmm. And I think that he finally felt safe with me. Mm.
You said so much, and I just want to respond to a couple of things that you said, mm-hmm. you know, just the importance of saying names correctly. Some people might call that a microaggression, but one of my mentors here at Teachers College, Dr. Bettina Love, one of the things she said in a presentation was, how do you get to decide what's a microaggression? You know, like this idea of like a micro, it may not be micro to the person who's experiencing it, you know, right. at all. So it's like, mm-hmm. after I heard her say that, I was like, whoa, that word is canceled now because, yeah. you know, like you cannot say that something was a microaggression because to the person experiencing it, it may be totally macro. Huge. So like, you don't get to, yeah. it's sort of like a gaslighting or like a de-minimizing it mm-hmm. by calling it micro. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. when you talked about this love ethic that you bring to the classroom, I mean, mm-hmm. I definitely was thinking automatically about bell hooks, but I was also thinking about people, scholars like Goldie Muhammad. You know, it's really a Black feminist ethic, that approach mm-hmm. to teaching and learning, which is one of the reasons why it's so important to have Black women teachers, Black teachers yes. in schools. Myself, I didn't have, in my K-12 experience, I didn't mm-hmm. have not one single Black teacher.
Wow.
So it was when I went to college, but actually, you know, my parents, because of the extracurricular planning that they would, you know, outside of school, my dad's from Louisiana, my mother, his family's from Virginia and California, they would, you know, take us to the South every South. So I got like a Black education, a Black experience outside of school. And then in middle school, they signed me up to go to Mexico, study abroad, because my dad was a professor as well. And I don't know how he finagled it, but he got me in with some college students, my sister and I. She was in high school and I was middle school. And I studied abroad in Mexico. I saw my first Diego Rivera mural. That's when I fell in love with art. Because I walked in the room and I was like, whoa, what's
this? That's amazing.
You know, first of all, it's huge. So the scale of it was like, you know, and then Rivera, I mean, inspired many Black artists. You know, it tells the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's like truth telling. Yes. So for me, that's when I learned early on that, I'm not in my school environment, which was always predominantly white in a suburb of Rochester, New York, a small town called Penfield. Mm-hmm. I learned early on from that experience, okay, it's the artist who's going to tell truth. They're the ones who I want to teach me. So I had to seek them out, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's a lifelong journey. I'm still seeking them out to the point where I'm sitting with you right now, you know? You know, so it's just, so there, when you were saying, I was like, and then you talked about basically what I'm going to say is self-regulation, you know, social emotional consciousness that a teacher has to have, not only of their students, but of themselves, like this, this, you know, this notion that a teacher has to be constantly self-reflective as well. And so, I mean, those are like some things I just had to like, you know, respond to. I mean, there's so much. Yeah. I just, So you talked about, I've heard you talk about in other interviews and read that you talked about self-esteem was one of the biggest issues that came up with your high school students, what you were teaching. And I was wondering if you, for the listeners, if you can help them to understand, how does artistic practice, how would that be helpful in building self-esteem?
I think that talking to our students, talking to young people about imagery, you know, I used to do a lesson on portraiture and I would say, make a portrait of somebody who you admire. But I would talk to them about like looking inward and looking at someone you admire doesn't always have to be a celebrity. What about your own mom, your grandmother, your grandfather, your uncle, somebody in your neighborhood, but look at the people around you who are actually doing things for you. And I think that it starts to make them realize the value of, if they haven't already, of acknowledging portions of themselves. My grandmother taught me, and she's valuable, therefore I am valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Also teaching portraiture, self-portraiture, having kids look at themselves and sketch themselves on a piece of paper and understanding that we all have these things alike where you have uniqueness that is beautiful and you don't need to change it. In your portrait, you're trying to get an accurate picture of what you look like and not some idealized Photoshopped image of yourself, because it's not going to be what you see in the mirror. I think that having students pick out colors that actually look like their own skin and teaching them how to mix those colors and blend them, give them a certain appreciation for their own skin tone, like whether it be light, medium, dark, reddish, yellowish, bluish, or whatever the undertones are, letting them understand the complexity of their own skin and having them play around with how to get it right. Or how their skin is not all one color at one time.
Mm.
I think it taught them more about, I don't know to say that it taught them, but exposed to them the idea that their own features, complexions were beautiful. And then also it exposed to them the idea that the inner beauty can be captured as well. Like if you're doing a portrait of someone you admire, they have inner beauty. There's a reason why you admire this person over this celebrity person. A celebrity, you don't know what their inner is.
Mm.
You know the outer and you know what they do. But a person in your life, you actually do know an aspect of their inner. So how are we going to portray that? And that's how I would go about assessing a quilt project, a portrait quilt. How are we going to show the outer beauty and the inner beauty in this one two-dimensional, well, sort of three-dimensional form of artwork. And I think it became reflective for the students too, because then they started thinking about themselves in the same way. I can sketch, paint, and put highlights down on this paper, but how am I going to show somebody something about what's inside of me? And to do that, I have to value something that's inside of me. So I think that that helped a lot in the classroom. These children would change after that lesson and be also more accepting of those differences.
Beautiful, beautiful. You know, I used to be a science teacher, and I would incorporate arts in my science classroom. I'm one of the teachers who believes that, you know, in this idea around integrating arts in multi-subject classrooms, you know, it could be a social studies class and you're engaging with arts. It could be a gym class, you're engaging with arts. It can be any class. Like, you know, it doesn't just have to be in the art classroom that we're engaging with arts. And so, you know, so when you're saying that, it just makes me think of all the multiple ways, you know, that this really could be amplified. So I love to talk to artists about their studio practice. One of the things, you know, that excites me when I look at art is I sort of like imagine, what does their studio look like? What do they look like? Are they messy? Are they neat? Are they on the floor? You know, I start imagining, like, you know, sometimes you could see handwork. So you start to like see, you know, I can imagine like the gestures, or, you know, I'm wondering about the conditions of the studio. Yes. So can you talk about what conditions you require in your studio that foster creativity? What does the opposite for you? What do you look like in the studio? Are you messy? Are you neat? I've heard that you like to listen to music. Yes. So can you talk about that as well?
Well, this right now I'm sitting in my studio, but this is my first studio ever. So it's a new experience for me to be able to have space. I always worked in the home, as do most quilters. It's a home-based craft. You know, it was a craft that people used to make blankets and warmth for their families. Sometimes quilts were done in a group, but even that might be like in a community center, not that far from home, or in a friend's home, or even outside in the yard. I used to just need a space on a table and good lighting, and then something to hold my fabric. The table was good for me because I worked on the dining room table and my daughters could do their homework at one end, and then I could do my quilts at the other end. And so I would have my children nearby and I could keep an eye on them. When they were really small, I used to sit on the sofa with like a lap cloth and work on projects a small bit at a time. And they would be like, this is like when they're like toddler age, just sort of toddling around or rolling around on the rug or climbing over me. But I kept my work close to my body, and I didn't really spread out because I had to use part of the home for other things.
Right.
Like the studio space now, I have like big tables that are probably like dining room tables still. And my machines are bigger. But this is my first experience not having my studio be in my house. And it's just the studio being wherever you are, where you happen to be sitting, you have a bag with all your supplies in it, and then you can work on your lab. Like the studio was like with me. And now it's in its external place. That's a lot more organized. I do need like a clean table before I start. I can't have stuff all over. And then my fabrics, some of them are vintage. They're my mother's and my grandmother's. Or some of them I bought, but I have to make sure that there's no food or drink besides water, because I don't want to get any oils. So I always wash my hands kind of a lot, and I don't want any food anywhere near. And you have to keep your sewing machine as your main tool. You have to keep it dust-free and in good working condition, oiled and ready to go. Like, you really do have to, like most art practices, though, you have to take care of your materials. And for the first time, I have a fabric room that's on the side here, which is it's like a library, has been stacked up to the ceiling, and I have like a rolling ladder that I can get things down. Where my fabric used to be in the basement or in boxes in my dining room, and then some of them are in the study, they were just like all over the house. So this is the first time that I've been able to have all my fabric in one place, and I can go to my grandmother's fabric easily, go to my mom's fabric, or go to some new beaded or rhinestone fabric that I just bought.
Is there a time of day that you like to work? And I just want to point out, you started going full time in 2018, so it's not that long ago. So when you said, you know, when you say this your first studio space, it sounds so shocking, but then I hear the way you talk about the way you work. But so are you going there like in the morning, or you like to work at certain times of the day?
I got here early-ish today, but I'm not a real morning bird at all. I'm a night owl.
A night owl.
Yes, I will get here around 10 in the morning, late morning, and like eat breakfast here.
Okay.
And I probably don't leave sometimes until around 11. I think like it seems like after when the sun goes down, I find like my work to be more intense. Like I find my brain shifting into whatever mode when it's darker. I know some people wake up really early and they're going. My brain is kind of sluggish in the morning. I'll work, but I don't think that I get into the zone, that like unconscious work zone, until it's darkened.
Is there anything that you have to do with your body? I know you're working with big machines now. So is there, do you do like any kind of stretching or anything like that?
Yes. I do have to do a lot of stretching, and I've been trying to make my core stronger and my arms. So I've been focusing on push-ups this past couple of weeks.
Okay.
Because I think that my arms need to be strong.
Yeah, yeah. I was listening to you in another interview talking about with the smaller machines, you had to push, but with these big machines, they have like the racks. So, and I was like, whoa, that's a whole nother use of your body. Can you talk about your playlist? What are you listening to?
Oh my goodness. Yesterday I was listening to the Bee Gees. I was like, I just felt like, because I had been listening in the jungle, and I was like, nah, jungle is not, I mean, I do like them, but what came before that? Or that sort of like disco-ish, I don't know if it's disco, but anyway, soft rock 80s sound or 70s. But then I started listening to the Bee Gees. And then I went down a Fleetwood Mac journey. And then I started to listen to Stevie Nicks, because I didn't grow up on that kind of music at all. So these songs are like kind of new to me. To my formative years, I was a child like during the disco era. And neither of my parents were really Motown people because of where they grew up.
Yeah.
I didn't discover Motown until I was in high school with my friends. And then my discovery for Motown was just being with my husband, John, who's a DJ, understanding the root of hip hop. Then, so Motown became immensely interesting for me to hear. Yesterday, me and my husband were listening to Bob James. And on the radio, they were talking about how many songs had inspired hip hop songs, had used portions of his music.
Right.
And I also like the sound of Philadelphia. So I find myself liking older music more than newer music lately.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I did want to ask you about research, because I'm always telling people, artists are scholars. They are researchers. And listening to you talk, you know, studying you, preparing for today, and just in general, you know, I hear you talk a lot about how you research photographs, and then you find these photographs through, and the ways that you're finding them sounds like many different ways that you're coming upon them. But you said you started out with Google, and then you find these images, but then that leads you down another path where you start researching, like when you find an image of Scott or Harriet Tubman or Frederick Douglass, who's buried in my hometown, Rochester. And so then you're reading Frederick Douglass' book and you're, you right. know, so I just wondered if you could speak to the role of research in your practice. What does research look like? Do you have research assistants? Mm-hmm. How do you know when you're done with the research or ready to go into, like, you know, at what point does the research sort of start into convert into making? And is it still kind of an ongoing thing?
To me, the research portion was part of the fun. Finding a photo or discovering a photo online, whether or not I saw it in a university archive or national archives, or even I seen photos on Instagram or on Pinterest. That is the beginning, but that's just like a big clue for a puzzle. And the research part is fun to me to try to figure out who this person was, or even if I can't do that, who the photographer was, and what are the circumstances. History has always been so interesting to me. It's almost like a game of mystery, right? Mm-hmm. Here's a clue. Here's this person. Now you have to figure out as much as you can about this person. And I think it's rewarding, satisfying for me to figure out if this person lived or did not, like how much longer past this photograph and what caused them to have the thing that's drawing me in. Sometimes it's like a very noble look or an intriguing look. Like, what can I glean from this person's life that will cause them to look like that? Seeing like a young photo of Frederick Douglass, you know, what caused him to have that fierce expression throughout his whole life? And then looking at very young photos of Frederick Douglass is pretty shocking. Seeing him in his 30s, you get to learn something new, that his expression was even more fierce at that point. It becomes an excavation of hidden history, especially because our history that's taught in public schools, who I was a kid of public schools, is so broken down mm-hmm. or non-existent. Right. You know, we'll see like that same portrait of the older statesman, Frederick Douglass, and a little bit about him being an abolitionist or somebody who escaped from slavery, but that'd be like the it.
Mm-hmm.
So getting into the real story, what happened in his life to cause him to have that kind of look on his face? And then I becomes like a social experiment in me looking at people that I know, thinking to myself, well, I don't know anybody who walks around with that expression or who takes photos like that. So what has changed or what is different?
Mm.
The sociological aspect of it is really interesting to me. What is that person thinking? And then the research too is really fun when I get into their clothes. Trying to figure out, first of all, people who are not supposed to, I'm using quotes because we've been told that Black people in this era did not dress a certain way and didn't have loose things, but I'm seeing the contrary.
Mm.
Even in young photos of Harriet Tubman, I'm seeing quite the contrary, where she's wearing a beautiful dress and it is not in rags. For me to figure out, what's the name of that shirt of 1,000 pleats? And how is something like that made? Is it made by hand? Is it made by machine? I think I had read that Frederick Douglass' wife and sister-in-law made many of his clothing.
Mm.
So how many outfits did he have? You know? And how much he was a dandy. Like a lot of these things in black and white photos, you see the sheen. He clearly liked silk a lot. And then it just gives me an insight into the real person.
Yeah.
Right? There's one thing of what you are projecting and speaking about, but who knew that Frederick Douglass was fly, like in that way?
Right.
You know, and like was, I would think, probably pretty bold wearing stripes and checkers together, even now. And what are those colors? I would think he was probably more akin to what we see online. My husband watched SportsCenter and all the football players who were commentators wear these beautiful custom suits, like Michael Strahan and such. and they'll contrast the patterns and the textures, and their suits are fitted to death. And they're very much like Frederick Douglass, who was also a big guy who liked really nice suits. So the research aspect for me is fulfilling.
Yeah.
Because it gives me something that may not be written about at all. There might be a book somewhere written about Frederick Douglass clothes. There must be. There must be, right? But it gives me an insight that they're Schulte.
Mm.
And it could have little fabric samples in it. And, you know, so that we could see, like, what colors were they actually wearing? What were the styles of the day? And then why?
Yeah.
I loved researching Harriet Tubman, how she was dressed when she was younger compared to how she was dressed when she was older, how the fashions had changed and the styles had changed. And he was just a more elderly woman. How does that change as well, how she presented herself?
Well, you know, speaking of style, first of all, I want to really let you know I appreciate and value your inquiry-based approach to research. And I think this is something that, you know, I was even going to ask you about inquiry-based, but I was like, no, I know she's going to start asking questions. So you did, you know, you ask so many questions, and when I've been reading and listening to you speak, it's like, you know, you're asking so many questions. And I just love how that sort of is like guides you. Your inquiry-based approach to mm-hmm. your practice is just amazing. And then mm-hmm. also, one of my professors here, Dr. Chris Emden, he always says, change the world and dress well doing it. And he's always dressed fresh to death.
I love it.
Yeah, I studied with Dr. Cornell West. He was always dressed fresh
wow.
to death, you know.
Yes.
And so I love this. And even I remember going to MLK Memorial in Atlanta, and there was mm-hmm. a whole part about his fashion and,
wow.
and Ms. Keene's fashion. And I have to say, every time I've, you know, like I said, I've shared the space with you a couple of times, you're always fresh to death. Like, you know, you come in looking like, I'm like, oh my gosh, look at what she's just is so beautiful and your clothes. And I start wondering, like, how many outfits does she have? Is she making these outfits?
Too many.
Yeah. So it's just beautiful. I think you may be inspired by that fashion ethic.
I am.
Yeah.
I actually am. I think about that. I'm like, well, if Frederick Douglass has, and then he wears cravats. All different ones in each photo. They're not the same cravat style. I'm like, if he could do that much, at least I can do was get it together.
Yes, yes. I mean, and that's why, you know, I just look at you as your practice, but also your person as, you know, so much of a model. We have so much to learn from your practice, your process, the work that you're making. When you're doing this research on these various individuals, we get to learn about, now you're passing it on to us, we get to learn about mm-hmm. these individuals. So you're constantly, yeah. you know, you're still teaching through
yes.
your practice. And I love that. And I just wanted to name that.
Thank
yeah.
you.
And I have to say, I appreciate, you know, as a doctoral student, I obviously would, you know, be on a tight budget and a solo mom. Mm-hmm. So I was thrilled that I was able, you know, I still want my daughter to have art on the walls. And LACMA
yes.
had a custom print of your Chadwick Boseman piece. And
oh, yes.
I was so excited about that. I got it framed and it's like, I have a piece of Butler on my wall.
Thank you.
I was just so grateful. And you made that accessible in that way for me to be able to live with, you know, your work as a doctoral student.
Thank you.
So
yes. They did an amazing job with that print. For anybody who got one, they used that heavy paper and it was so pigmented.
It was so nice. I had to get it framed.
And it was affordable. They could have charged way more. I was like, are you guys sure? Are you sure?
Yes. Well, I benefit from that and I'm grateful.
Yes.
Though, so thank you. It's up. My daughter's growing up looking at that piece. So I appreciate it.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you.
So my last question is, what advice do you have for moms or teachers mm-hmm. who are also artists and trying to negotiate all these roles?
Moms, teachers, artists, people who are working. I guess we always have to, they always say, be kind to yourself. You know, you're not perfect, but all you can do is your very best. And once that, if you've exceeded that, take a breath, because nobody is perfect. At least try to organize your day, because we tend to give everything for other people. I feel like we as women, you know, we'll go to the doctor last, you know, or forget about like pampering type things, like getting a massage or something like that. That tends to be last on the list when you're in a situation where, you know, things are survival.
Mm.
And we look at our children or those dependent on us as so very important, which they are. So they're always coming before us. But just to remember to have that little bit for you. I made sure that my kids got school and they had successful play dates or not. You know, if the play date didn't go so well, hug and kiss them, you know, take them to the park, try to nurture their social and emotional well-being along with helping them with their homework and keeping them healthy, well-fed, and clean, that too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot that goes into rearing a child. And then there's a lot that goes into if you're in school, you're working, you want to do your best at work, and you want to have good relationships at work and feel like you're successful. But to try to keep a little portion for yourself, because I wouldn't be here if I hadn't kept making artwork. Even if the artwork I was making was the size of a piece of notebook paper,
mm-hmm.
and I was just gluing fabric on that paper, I still did a little something. I always kept a journal / diary. I'm always writing, getting my thoughts out.
Mm.
And we have to have like these sacred private spaces to do something. Because after a while, some of these other things will fall by the wayside, or they will grow up and grow away from you. And my daughters are 24 and 28 now, and they're doing very well. They've been a tremendous amount of support to me. I still support them and what they need, and they've been a tremendous support for me as well. But me and my husband are empty nesters, and I'm so grateful that I have something for myself.
Mm-hmm.
That small little portion that might have been only 30 minutes of my day is now my whole day.
Mm.
But beautiful. We have to nurture like our inner self. I used to like to, my mom used to open the junk drawer and take it out and put it on the floor and let me mess with whatever was in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was starting from about 6. So I was old enough not to know to like swallow things.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be like old thimbles in there, or like thread, or like a playing card, some glue. I would just make little assemblages or little structures, little mini sculptures.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning, I would say, just nurturing that creative side.
Mm.
You're not making this for anyone. It's not going to be judged. You're not submitting it for anything. You're just making. And I kept that throughout my whole life. One of my aunts my aunt Lydia, who was a photographer in Paris, told me, make sure you have a space for yourself. My husband always had like his DJ equipment, so he would usually have the basement or a room. And that was, of course, he should have a space. And she'd be like, make sure you have a space for yourself. Now, I didn't actually listen it all the way
mm-hmm.
because I always felt like this, I couldn't take over study. We need to have the study.
Mm-hmm.
But I always had an inner space for myself to do me.
Mm.
And I think that's intensely important. It helps give you sanity and it gives you direction. And it's something for you when other things will not be there.
Bisa Butler, you honor me with your presence today. You honor us all with your insights. I am so inspired by and proud of you. I just am so excited to continue to watch. I know you have a lot of things happening, things in the works right now, and I'm so excited,
yes.
You know, for all those things to come, to continue to engage with your practice. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for your time today. This has really just been an enlightening conversation for me, a really joyous moment.
Thank you so much, Jacqueline. I wish you and your little one nothing but the best. And I'm so excited to be here. I enjoyed it. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's been a privilege to share this space with an artist who amplifies the craft of quilting to extraordinary heights of expression and cultural storytelling. Bisa Butler's narrative and her transformative approach to quilting and storytelling enrich our understanding of art's potential to celebrate and elevate the narratives of the African diaspora. Bisa's dedication to bringing historical figures to life through vibrant, tactile art forms is a true inspiration. Keep exploring, keep questioning, and most importantly, keep creating. Don't forget to follow us on your favorite streaming platform to catch every episode of Beyond Beauty. Until next time, keep embracing the beauty that surrounds us in every stitch and every story. Thank you for joining me in this conversation on Beyond Beauty Season 2. I hope these stories have inspired you as much as they have me, showing that beauty and art goes beyond the canvas, beyond the medium. It's in the histories, identities, and dreams these artists share. Let their stories remind us of the power that art holds to connect, reflect, and create meaning in our lives. Until next time, stay curious, stay open-minded, and continue to explore the beauty that lies beyond beauty.